Welcome to Christchurch Manchester Sermon Podcast. CCM is one church that meets every Sunday in various locations across Manchester. For more information about who we are or about our Sunday meetings, please visit www.christchurchmanchester.com.
My home is not on this earth, not in this world.
I just want to start this morning by sharing one of my favorite TV series of all time is Band of Brothers. Anyone ever seen Band of Brothers? Yes, quite a few of you have seen Band of Brothers. Okay, for those of you who haven't seen Band of Brothers, it is a TV series based on a true story which follows a company of American soldiers in the parachute regiment in the Second World War. So it kind of follows them around all the battles they did. They've parachuted in the day before D-Day, and they were right in the thick of the action for the next year in the Second World War. And because they were really good at what they did, they were really good soldiers, they always ended up being sent to the front line. They always got sent to where the battle was the thickest and hardest, which meant that their company, they lost a lot of men in the Second World War. And I was rewatching the series just a few weeks ago, I got to the last episode, and it gets right to the end, and Germany has surrendered, and Easy Company, they're all there, they're all relaxing in southern Germany, and there's this nice green meadow, and they're playing baseball together, just chilling out, hanging out, having a good time. And the war is still going on, because Japan is still fighting America over in the Pacific, and these soldiers are going to be sent to Japan to fight the Japanese, and they're getting ready to do that. And then, just in the middle of their baseball game, their commanding officer walks in, he says, "Guys, hold up, gather around, come in." And in the way that I think they only really do in the army, when they never say more than they have to, he just says, "Guys, Japan's surrendered. War's over. Play on." And just walk up. That was it. And but from that moment, all those soldiers were free to go home. There'd be no more battles, there'd be no more shooting, there'd be no more death, there'd be no more suffering. They were free to go home. And that moment, when World War II was declared to be over, meant that not just those guys in that kind of documentary, but millions and millions of people right across the world, soldiers, prisoners, civilians, right across the world, were now free to go home. And this morning we're going to look at another moment in world history which also led to many people being freed to go home. This morning the moment in world history we're going to look at is the Passover. That night 3,500 years ago when God passed over the houses of the Israelites who'd spread the blood of the Lamb on their doorposts so that their firstborn sons would be saved. And as a result, God's people were freed from their slavery in Exodus. So we're going to look at this. The story of Exodus is in chapter 12 of Exodus. So we're going to look at Exodus chapter 12, verses 1 to 31. You can turn to that in your Bibles. It will appear on the screen behind us as well. But before we get into the passage, a little bit of background. So we know from this series we've been going through that God called Moses to free the Israelites. And Moses was a bit reluctant at first, but eventually he went back, goes to Pharaoh, says, "Free my people." And Pharaoh kind of was not happy about that. And as a result, he made the Israelites work harder. He made them make bricks without straw, which annoyed all the Israelite people because they got really annoyed at Moses. Moses had come in and said, "I'm going to free you." And the Israelites were like, "Well, you've just made our work, our lives a lot harder." And then Moses gets a bit despondent. God speaks to him, gives him a bit of pep talk, says, "No, Moses, we're going to do this. I'm going to do this. You're going to be my spokesperson. I'm going to send you and Aaron." And then he goes back to Pharaoh and says, "Let my people go." Pharaoh again says no. And then what we get, we looked at this last week, was the 10 plagues. So the Nile, the first one, the Nile is turned to blood. Still, Pharaoh won't let the people go. Then there's a plague of frogs. Just frogs come from everywhere and just plague the whole place. Still, Pharaoh won't let the people go. Then there's a plague of gnats. Just gnats come from everywhere, all over the place, everywhere. Still, Pharaoh won't let the people go. Now, the interesting thing about the first three plagues is that the Egyptians and the Israelites both endured the first three plagues. The Israelites weren't protected from the first three plagues. They all endured it. The next six plagues, though, the Israelites were protected from them. So then Moses goes back, and there's a plague of flies. Still, Pharaoh won't let the people go, but the Israelites, they're protected. The flies don't come into their area where they live. Then the livestock are killed, but the Israelites' livestock is fine. There's a plague of boils where all the Egyptians are covered in these really nasty, painful boils, but the Israelites are protected from that. Then there's a plague of hail. again, the Israelite area, there's hail all across Egypt, except in Goshen, the place where the Israelites live. It's protected. Then you've got this plague of locusts. Again, they go everywhere in Egypt, but the Israelites are protected. And then there's this plague of darkness. Like, darkness is in, like, you can't see someone standing right in front of you because it's so dark. The place just comes so dark, apart from the place where the Israelites are. There's light there. So God kind of protects them from these next six plagues. And still, through all these, Pharaoh still refuses to let the Israelites go. And then Moses, in chapter 11, he goes to Pharaoh and says, okay, this is we've got this final plague. The firstborn of the Israelites, of the Egyptians, are going to die, both humans and livestock, but the Israelites are going to be spared. So Moses kind of delivers this message to Pharaoh, and then he leaves. It says he leaves hot with anger. He's angry that it's just taken so all these plagues. So Moses leaves Pharaoh, and then that's where we pick up the story here in Exodus chapter 12. Now, pretty much Exodus 12 is like divided into two. So the first bit is God speaking to Moses, and God, first off, he tells Moses, here's what the people need to do to be spared from this, okay? Blood on the doorposts, eat the meal, everything. Then God says to Moses, this is what I'm going to do. And then God says to Moses, this is how you're going to remember this for years to come. And then the second part, Moses pretty much goes to the people and like just tells them a summarized version of what God's told them. And then right at the end of the section passage we're going to look at today, verses kind of 29 to 31, is the action. This is what actually takes place, okay? So God's speaking to Moses, Moses speaking to the people, then the action. So let's read the passage now, and then we'll have a look at a few things from it. So Exodus chapter 12, starting verse 1, okay? So this is God speaking to Moses about what they needed to do to be spared. The Lord said to Moses and Aaron in Egypt, this month is to be for you the first month of your year. Tell the whole community of Israel that on the 10th day of this month, each man is to take a lamb for his family, one for each household. If any household is too small for a lamb, they must share one with their nearest neighbor, having taken into account the number of people there are. You're to determine the amount of lamb needed in accordance with what each person will eat. The animals you choose must be year-old males without defect, and you may take them from the sheep or the goats. Take care of them until the 14th day of the month, when all the members of the community of Israel must slaughter them at twilight. Then they are to take some of the blood and put it on the sides and tops of the door frames of the houses where they eat the lambs. That same night they are to eat the meat roasted over the fire along with bitter herbs and bread made without yeast. Do not eat the meat raw or boiled in water, but roast it over a fire with the head, legs, and internal organs. Do not leave any of it till morning. If some is left till morning, you must burn it. This is how you're to eat it, with your cloak tucked into your belt, your sandals on your feet, and your staff in your hands. Kind of like eating a meal at the airport when your plane's about to come, isn't it? Eat it in haste. That's what he's saying. It is the Lord's Passover. So that's what God says to Moses about what the people need to do to be spared. Next, God says to Moses what he's going to do, verse 12 and 13. On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals. And I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord. The blood will be a sign for you on the houses where you are. And when I see the blood, I will pass over you. No destructive plague will touch you when I strike Egypt. And then in verses 14 to 20, we see God tell Moses how they're going to remember this moment for years to come. It says this, verse 14, this is a day you are to commemorate. For the generations to come, you shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance. For 7 days, you are to eat bread made without yeast. On the first day, remove the yeast from your houses, for whoever eats anything with yeast in it from the first day through the seventh must be cut off from Israel. On the first day, hold a sacred assembly and another one on the seventh day. Do no work on all these days. I'm sure they were happy about that. Except to prepare food for everyone to eat. That is all you may do. Verse 17, celebrate the festival of unleavened bread because it was on this very day that I brought your divisions out of Egypt. Celebrate this day as a lasting ordinance for the generations to come. In the first month, you're to eat bread made without yeast from the evening of the 14th day until the evening of the 21st day. For 7 days, no yeast is to be found in your houses. And anyone, whether foreigner or native born, who eats anything with yeast in it must be cut off from the community of Israel. Eat nothing made with yeast. Wherever you live, you must eat unleavened bread. So this whole idea of no yeast, to put yeast in bread, you've got to wait for it to rise. And the whole idea of the meal is that they don't have time because they're leaving. That's why there's no yeast going in there. That's what it represents. Now, so that's what God says to Moses. Now, Moses kind of gives a summarized version of all that God's told him to the people. And we see that verse 21 to 28. Then Moses summoned all the elders of Israel and said to them, "Go at once and select the animals for your families and slaughter the Passover lamb. Take a bunch of hyssop, which is a plant, kind of a branch, dip it into the blood in the basin and put some of the blood on the top and both sides of the door frame. None of you should go out of the door of your house until morning, when the Lord goes through the land to strike down the Egyptians. He will see the blood on the top and sides of the doorframe and will pass over that doorway, and he will not permit the destroyer to enter your houses and strike you down. Verse 24, obey these instructions as a lasting ordinance for you and your descendants when you enter the land that your Lord will give you, as he promised. Observe this ceremony. And when your children ask you, 'What does this ceremony mean to you?' then tell them, 'It is the Passover sacrifice to the Lord who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt and spared our homes when he struck down the Egyptians.' Then the people bowed down and worshipped. The Israelites did just as the Lord commanded Moses and Aaron." And then this final section, verse 29 to 31, we see what actually happened. At midnight, the Lord struck down all the firstborn in Egypt, from the firstborn of Pharaoh who sat on the throne to the firstborn of the prisoner who was in the dungeon, and the firstborn of all the livestock as well. Pharaoh and all his officials and all the Egyptians got up during the night, and there was loud wailing in Egypt, for there was not a house without someone dead. During the night, Pharaoh summoned Moses and Aaron and said, 'Up, leave my people, you and the Israelites, go worship the Lord as you have requested.'" So that is the story of the Passover. And as we see, the next chapter basically recounts how the Israelites actually do get up and leave and are freed from Israel. And there's just a few things I want us to see, a few things I think the Passover shows us as believers here today. And I want us to just focus on these just in the remaining minutes I have with you here. The first thing I think the Passover shows is that true freedom comes from God. True freedom only comes from God. Now, what I find really interesting about the 10 plagues is that in the first 9 plagues, Moses and Aaron always had something to do to bring the plague about. So normally they'd, you know, hit the dust with their staff or stretch out their arm or something and the plague would start. That's normally how the first 9 went. But with the 10th plague, they didn't do anything. They were spectators because God came and delivered the 10th plague himself. And in verse 12, God says, "On that same night, I will pass through Egypt." He says, "I'm not sending Moses and Aaron. I'm doing this one myself." So God delivered the 10th plague himself, the one that led to the Israelites being freed. So their freedom came directly from God. Now, one of my favorite films is the film Braveheart. Anyone seen Braveheart? Mm-hmm. We've got a great picture of Mel Gibson, right, in battle, all painted up. And everything. I love Braveheart. So for those of you who haven't seen Braveheart, it's the main character is played by Mel Gibson. He plays William Wallace, who is a Scottish freedom fighter fighting against the English, the evil English, back in the 12th century. And he fights all these battles against the English for Scotland to be free. And eventually he gets caught at the end and he's being tortured. And the torturer basically is trying to make him kind of kiss the ring and give honor to the English king. And and as they're torturing, the kind of torturer leans in and says, "Just honor the king." And he leans in to hear what William Wallace is going to say. Can anybody tell me what he says?
Freedom.
Yes. And he says it just like that. He doesn't say freedom. He says this elongated freedom that lasts about 10 minutes. Freedom! Like shouts it at the top of his voice and everybody can hear it. And that's how the film ends. And it's this kind of great film where he just gives his whole life to fight for freedom. Great film. And freedom is something worth fighting for. It is something worth fighting for. I heard a quote by Ronald Reagan, the former US president. He said this: "Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction." Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction. And what he means is kind of political freedom, democracy. We have to fight to keep that. We have to fight to keep that. And if we don't, we can lose that. And, you know, many people down throughout history have laid down their lives fighting for our freedom, for the freedom we have in this country. And that is good, and it is right that we honor them for that. It is absolutely right that we honor them for that. But true freedom, and what I mean by true freedom is freedom on the inside, not just political freedom. True freedom, it means, true freedom is when things are well with our souls. It's when things are right on the inside. That kind of freedom only comes from God. That kind of freedom only comes from God. You can live in a free society, but not be free, okay? That kind of freedom only comes from God. Many of you know, I look after Max on a Wednesday. I'm babysitter on a Wednesday. Max is 2.5. He screams a lot. He's, you know, on a Wednesday I look after him, and I've discovered this new great thing to do on a Wednesday to kill a lot of time with Max. We go on the bus. We go on the 50 bus from the bottom of our road, and it takes an hour. We go the whole way to Salford Quays. He just sits there, looks out the window. He's happy. He's chilled, and I'm thinking, this is fantastic. I've just killed an entire morning without having to do anything. We get there. We have a coffee. We get back in the bus, and we come home again. That's pretty much it. Yeah, we're in Salford Quays for about 20 minutes, half an hour max, and then we just come back in the bus. It's great. But this Wednesday, I was... As I was driving, we kind of, you go through the city centre on the way there, and we're coming through the city centre, and I could see all these big, we're sitting on the top deck, I see all these big high rises being built, and just so much development and kind of things happening. And I just had this thought. I thought, you know, there is so much wealth and affluence in this city, but has it really made us happier? Has it really made us freer in the true sense of the word freedom? And I just, as I was thinking, I just thought of some of the statistics on mental health, anxiety, depression, suicide that we have in this country. And they're heartbreaking. I mean, they're going up, not down. And I don't think that's just to do with the fact that people are better at coming forward and sharing things today. I think there is something in our society that's harming us and affecting us. Now, I can't speak for everything, but I think there's something in our society where it's actually causing a lot of problems. And I think what it is that our society tells us that our value is determined by what we achieve in life. Our society tells us that our value is determined by what we achieve in life. And when we believe that, it puts us under immense pressure in life, pressure to achieve, pressure to be successful. And when you're not, you feel like you're not worth anything. And so what happens is, and this is not something that just we're immune to, it's not just something happens out there, it's something that happens to us. What happens is we work harder and harder and harder to achieve the things that we want, to achieve things like a good job, money, status, looking good, house, car, husband, wife, raising good children. We work harder and harder and harder to achieve these things. And before long, we've become slaves to these things. We've become slaves to these things. Why? Because we believe that our value is determined by how much we achieve in these areas in our life. Now, this all subconscious. None of us will verbalize that. But that's what happens for so many of us. And I just want to say, look, that is not true. True freedom does not come from achievement. Okay, no matter how much you achieve, no matter how high you rise in your job, no matter how much money you achieve, no matter how many Nobel Prizes your kids get, you know, no matter how much you achieve, true freedom doesn't come from any of those things. Okay, what society tells us is a lie. True freedom only comes from God. It comes from knowing that you are of immeasurable value to Him, so much so that He deemed you worth dying for. That's where true freedom comes from. That's where it comes from. Now, I talk about this stuff not abstractly, like I have experienced this in my life. So for me, I remember back when I started preaching quite regularly at my previous church about 7 or 8 years ago. And I started getting compliments. I was like, wow, this is new. I'd preach a sermon and people would come up and say, Andy, that was really good. And I would be like, oh, I like that. And then they would say things like, that was very challenging. Or I like that. And there's all these kind of comments that, and afterwards I've begun to quite like these comments. You know, I think these are nice. And then one time, the pastor of the church, he was kind of like my mentor, taught me how to preach. He said to me, Andy, I preached a sermon. He says this. He says, my wife told me to say this. I was like, okay, what is it? He says, she told me that, and he was the one who preached most of the church. He said, she told me to say that I could learn from you when it comes to preaching. Now, I didn't need my ego boosted, but oh my goodness. I mean, I could hardly get my head out of the door, you know? That was like, oh my goodness, I've arrived, you know? So, but I started to really like the compliments, and I started to kind of subconsciously started to kind of think, look, how can I write a sermon in a way that I get nice compliments? Now, I'm not going to be putting heresy in here. I'm not that kind of a guy. But, you know, how can I make this a little bit more engaging and fun and challenging and all that? So I began to work harder and harder on my sermon preparation to make them funnier and more challenging and more engaging. And when I look back now and I think, okay, why did I do that? The reason I did it, if I'm totally honest with myself, was not that like, oh, I want to honor God. It was so that people would say nice things to me afterwards. That's why I was doing it. And it came to a point where I just thought, why am I doing this? You know, why am I doing this? And I realized that putting all this extra work into my sermons was not to please God, but to please people so that they pay me compliments. And I realized I'd become a slave to pleasing people. I'd become a slave to pleasing people. And, you know, gradually, without me even knowing it, I'd begun to base my value in life on how much positive feedback I got off the back of sermons. It sounds crazy, doesn't it? But that's where it got to. And, you know, over a period, I kind of repented of that. And I said, sorry, I realized what had happened. I repented. And to be honest, when I kind of turned from that and repented from that, it was actually very freeing, really. It was a really freeing thing. It was like, you know, it's like God freed me to preach bad sermons again. It was like, yeah, great. And you're now the victim of that. Yeah. So he freed me to preach bad sermons again. He freed me to kind of tell people what they needed to hear, not what I thought they would enjoy hearing as well. So it was immensely freeing. Now, you may not be preaching sermons very often, but actually, I'm sure some of that kind of stuff can happen to some of us as well. We kind of get our value from something in life that is not from God. And in my life, when I think about it, the times in my life when I've felt most free have been when I've been most in love with God. And when my eyes have been taken off me and fixed on him. Those are the times in my life when I have been most free. Now, I was sharing this with Elizabeth the other day and about kind of freedom and Christians having freedom. And she says, look, if I said all this stuff you just said to me, to my work colleague, she's not a Christian, she would just say, what a load of rubbish. Christians aren't free. Christians have got loads of rules they've got to obey. They're not free. They've got all these rules. And I think that's a common misconception about what true freedom is. We kind of think freedom is just you can do whatever you want. But true freedom is not just being able to do whatever you want. True freedom comes from denying yourself some things so that you can have the best thing. That's what true freedom is. Denying yourself something so you can have the best thing, which is a relationship with God. That's true freedom. And it only comes from God. So that's the first thing the Passover shows us. True freedom comes from God. Now, the second thing the Passover shows us is that it's by grace that we're saved. It's by grace that we're saved. Now, 2 weeks ago, there's a lot of films and TV series in this sermon. I'm very sorry, but 2 weeks ago, I saw Aladdin in the cinema. Anyone seen Aladdin? Yeah, a few people have seen Aladdin. The Disney film, the new one with Will Smith in it. Now, the thing I noticed about Aladdin is, like all Disney films, it's very much, the story is very much good versus evil. And it's really easy to work out who the good guys are and who the evil guys are. Because the good guys are all fun and there's nice music plays in the background when they appear. The bad guys are normally dressed in black, look really sinister like that. And I know that the bad guy in Aladdin, he was all dressed in black, looked really sinister, had like an evil sounding name, an evil sounding laugh, had this big golden staff with a serpent's head on it and red eyes. So it wasn't hard to work out who the evil guy was. And it's this kind of battle between good and evil, and the good guys always win. And Disney always Wars does this with their films. Avengers do it, Star Wars. There's so many films that are just, the storyline is good versus evil, good wins, that's it. And what's interesting is about 20 years ago, Hollywood did a film of this story we're talking about, The Prince of Egypt. Anyone seen The Prince of Egypt? Yeah, animated film. What The Prince of Egypt does is it tries to do this too. It tries to depict this story we're talking about as good versus evil. Israelites, Moses, Aaron, good guys. Egyptians, bad guys, boo. You know, that's what they try to depict it as. And we like to think of this story like this, like Pharaoh bad, Israelites good. But that's not the right way to think about this story. Because if you read this story, you'll realize God is the only good guy in it. The Egyptians and the Israelites are both the bad guys, really. Now you're thinking, really? Now, even though the Israelites were slaves, they weren't actually much better morally than the Egyptians. I mean, the Israelites, they fought, they grumbled, they moaned, they worshipped idols, they disobeyed God's command. Israelites weren't good people. So if they weren't really much better than the Egyptians, if they weren't really good, well, then why did God rescue them? Well, Exodus 11, verse 6, God says this. He gives us the answer. He says, "Then you will know that the Lord makes a distinction between Egypt and Israel." And what this is saying is they weren't saved. The Israelites weren't saved because they were morally superior to the Egyptians, like in the Disney films. He said, no, they were saved because God chose them. He made a distinction between them and the Egyptians. They didn't deserve to be saved, but they were saved by grace, just as we are. So the Passover reminds us that it is by grace that we are saved. That was true for the Israelites in Egypt, and it's true for us too. And you know, I think as Christians, sometimes we can treat the grace of God a little bit like being married to someone for a long time. Okay, let's see where we're going with this. So I don't know, like at the start of a relationship, you kind of tend to give the other person quite nice presents, and you send them a nice card, and you write lots in them, and you send them letters, and you're quite attentive, and you might cook for them, or listen to them, or watch films that you hate because you just want to be with them. Okay, that's the things we kind of do at the start of a relationship. You're kind of totally focused on the other person, you're thankful for them, you're happy that you've got them in your life. But then what often happens is after a while, you kind of get used to the other person, you get a little bit familiar. Birthday presents get a bit cheaper, you know, gradually. Cards just gradually have less written in them, you know. It goes from like 10 lines to 5 to 4, you know. It's just what happens. And I'm not speaking from experience here, just by the way. This is completely hypothetical here, right? But it's easy to, after a while, to take the other person for granted. And when you've been in a relationship for a while, we have to be a bit more intentional about showing appreciation, about loving the other person, about being thankful for them. And I think the same is true for us as Christians. Same is true for us in the way we treat the grace of God. You know, sometimes the first time you become a Christian, like, wow, grace of God, fantastic, amazing. But then we've been a Christian for a while, it can get easy to take that for granted. And we have to be intentional, I think, about appreciating that. And for me, one of the things I do is I'll just have a few Bible verses that I just focus on and read and reread and reread that just remind me of the grace of God. And one of those that I've just been reading through this week is Ephesians chapter 2, verse 8. "For it is by grace you've been saved through faith, and this is not from yourselves, it is a gift from God." This week I'll open that up and I'll read it, and I'll read it, and I'll read it again, and I'll read it again, I'll read it slow, I'll read it fast, and I'll think about each word. And as I do, I just feel, oh yeah, I'm saved by grace. God has done this. I don't deserve it. It's free. And that just reminds me of who I am and what he's done. And it's such a good, simple thing to do for us as Christians. So that second thing Passover shows us, it's by grace that we're saved. Third and final thing that Passover shows us is to remember what God has done. To remember what God has done, okay? So one of the things, when I think of remembrance, I think of Remembrance Sunday. We have this ritual in our country. It's part of our national identity where every year we have a Sunday where we remember those who died in previous wars. And that is a good thing to do. We have sayings that we use for it, lest we forget. At the going down of the sun, what is it? We will remember them. Yeah, so we've got language, we've got emblems, poppies, and it's right that we shouldn't forget them. And one of the things that always makes me tear up on Remembrance Sunday. I don't know why, because like I don't know anyone who's fought in wars or anything, but is that, you know when they get the bugler out and they do the last, what is it, last post, and they play that song, and it just the note just, I'm like, Elizabeth will look at me, she's like, what, are you all right, Andy? It's like, yep, fine, I'm all right. I don't know what it is, it just, yeah. But we have this kind of thing every year where we remember, and the same thing is true with the Passover. God wants us to remember it. Verse 14, God says, "This is a day you are to commemorate for the generations to come. You shall celebrate it as a festival to the Lord, a lasting ordinance." And what are they to remember? Well, verse 27 says they're to remember the Lord who passed over the houses of the Israelites in Egypt and spared our homes when he struck down the Egyptians. Now, just as we finished, question. Have you ever wondered why the Passover even happened at all? Like, why was it even needed? Like, why did God get the people to put lamb's blood on their doorposts and have a meal? Now, if you think about it, you kind of think, okay, well, God needed to know where the Israelites lived. Well, if you think about it, God protected the Israelites from the previous six plagues without needing any markings on doorposts to help them. Okay, so it's not like he needed them to put blood on their doors, on their doorposts, so he knew where they lived. He knew exactly where they lived. Okay, so why does God tell them to kind of do the blood and the meal and all the Passover thing? Why didn't he just, you know, kill the firstborn Egyptians and then Pharaoh would let them go and there'd be no need for all the kind of stuff on the doorposts? Well, Exodus 6 helps explain it. In Exodus 6, verses 6 to 7, God says this about when he would free the Israelites. He says, "I will redeem you with an outstretched arm and with mighty acts of judgment." Basically, he's saying, I'm going to send the 10 plagues, and the result will be that you will be free. And then he says, in the next bit of the verses, "I will take you as my people and I will be your God." Okay, so these verses tell us there are two things God wanted through this whole thing. Two things he wanted. Okay, firstly, he wanted freedom for his people, which is what the 10 plagues and the death of the firstborn Egyptians achieved. Okay, that's what the mighty acts of judgment is referring to in this verse. But the verse says, "I will take you as my people and I will be your God." Secondly, he wanted relationship with his people, which is what the Passover achieved. Now, how does the Passover achieve relationship? Well, what God did was God involved his people by getting them to put the blood on the doorposts and eating the meal, even though he didn't need them to. Why? Because he wanted relationship with them. Sometimes Max helps me empty the dishwasher. It's not a help. It takes twice as long. But I like it because it's about relationship. We're doing something together. And the same is true with this, with the Passover. It's about relationship. God's involving them. But the Passover also helps the people develop a relationship with God because it would become a festival every year when his people would remember what God had done and they would worship and praise him. See, celebrating significant events together always helps build relationship. Elizabeth had her birthday party 2 weeks ago. Lots of you were there. It was something that helped develop relationship. And the same is true with this Passover festival that they're going to remember. So Passover is about relationship, but that's not the only reason why we have the Passover. The Passover also pointed to something much bigger in the future. The reason Elizabeth and I went to see Aladdin was because 2 weeks before we saw the trailer and we thought, "Oh, that looks good. Let's go see that. That would be great." The trailer pointed to the film. The Passover is kind of like the trailer that points to the main event. It's like the main event is what we're looking to. The main event is, the trailer's like the main event, but the main event is so much better. And this main event that the Passover points to, it would happen 1,500 years later. God would send his son Jesus who came into the world. And he too fled Egypt and came out of it. He too was later called the Lamb of God who would take away the sin of the world. And 3 years later, he was killed. His blood was shed over pieces of wood so that we could be freed. Not freed from the Egyptians, but freed from something much bigger. Freed from the power of sin and death. The Passover is the trailer pointing us to the main event, which is the cross, which is where we receive our freedom, which is where the way is open for us to enter into into a relationship with God. Isn't that good news? Good news. And it was the Passover celebration in Jerusalem, 1,500 years after the Israelites left Egypt, that Jesus, in an upper room with his disciples, transformed the Passover meal. Because on that night he was betrayed, he took bread, and when he had given thanks, he broke it and said, "This is my body, which is for you. Do this in remembrance of me." In the same way, after supper, he took the cup, saying, "This cup is the new covenant in my blood. Do this whenever you drink it in remembrance of me." So the band are going to come up. We're going to take communion now. Let's stand on our feet. Let's just stand on our feet. And I'm just going to pray before we take communion, before we remember what Jesus did for us by dying on the cross.